Anybody, how many people here have published a book? This is a community of writers, after all. How many people have published a book? Yeah, okay. Yeah. Or written a book. Keep your hands up. Written a book. Thought about writing a book. How many people here have thought about writing a book ever? Yeah, okay, that's what I thought. That's what I thought. Okay, so I have a couple of modest suggestions if you're contemplating that idea based on experience. First of all, if you feel like you want to write a book and you go into a meeting with an editor, say at a nice New York publishing house, do not say, it's going to be a 400-page book about the history of molecular phylogenetics. Okay? Don't do that. No. And when her eyes roll, or his, don't say, no, 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 the lighter side of molecular phylogenetics. That still, it still is not going to work very well. Maybe what you want to say is what I said, which is, okay, it's going to be a book about the most important biologist of the 20th century that you've never heard of. Try that. It worked okay for me. Might not work again, but anyway, that's the idea. So at the center of this book, which is, I have to confess, it is a history of molecular phylogenetics, the lighter side, with people, told with people stories, with human narratives. People want to read about people. So the way I have tried to present this constellation of, I argue, really important, counterintuitive, and fascinating facts and ideas stretched over about 150 years leading up to new challenging understandings today of who we are, where we've come from, and how we deal with the world. The way I've tried to deal with that is by telling people stories. Stories about characters, stories about the great microbiologist Lynn Margulis of the late 20th century, a little story about Barbara McClintock, stories about Darwin and a fellow named Ernst Haeckel, who was Darwin's greatest popularizer in the late 19th century, a crazy German naturalist who just loved Darwin and drew trees of life, evolutionary trees of life. And a number of others, but at the center, my main character is this man that I alluded to, the most important biologist of the 20th century that you've never heard of. And when I say his name, raise your hand if I'm wrong and you have heard of him. Karl R. Woese. Karl R. Woese. Karl R. Woese was a little white-haired microbiologist and biophysicist at the University of Illinois, in most conspicuously in the 1970s. On November 3rd, 1977, he appeared on the front page of the New York Times, above the fold, next to articles about Patty Hearst and other things, apartheid in South Africa. And here's this picture of this guy in a sports shirt, with his feet up on his desk wearing Adidas, and behind him is a blackboard with all sorts of cryptic squiggles and equations and figures on it. I think there were equations, maybe not. And a story describing the discovery of a new form of life, a separate form of life, a major kingdom of life previously unknown on planet Earth. There were, until that time, only two known kingdoms of life on Earth. There were the bacteria, and there was everything else. And everything else included animals, humans, plants, fungi, and complex, relatively complex microorganisms that had cell nuclei and complex internal structures. So it was the bacteria on one hand and all these creatures that are composed of complex cells with cell nuclei on the other hand. The fancy name for them is eukaryotes, the kingdom Eukarya, E-U-K-A-R-Y-A, bacteria Eukarya. Woese announces on the front page of the New York Times, he announced in a journal paper that the front page of the New York Times was describing, that lo and behold, he had found a third kingdom of life. So now start imagining an evolutionary tree of life. There's a trunk representing all of the common origin of all life, and there are two major limbs, bacteria, everything else, Eukarya. And Woese is saying there's a third limb. There's a third limb of life, a third kingdom of life, and these creatures were also microbes. Through a microscope, they looked like bacteria, and they had been taken for bacteria for 100 years. Woese said they're not bacteria. Matter of fact, they're not even close to bacteria. They're closer to us than they are to bacteria. And the evidence is not microscopy, but genetic sequencing. He had begun to do a very laborious, primitive form of genetic sequencing in his laboratory in Urbana, Illinois, with some very brave and forgiving assistants and graduate students and postdoctoral fellows, using toxic chemicals and explosive chemicals and high voltage and radioactive phosphorus, doing all this in order to sequence just fragments of one molecule that he decided was the Rosetta Stone molecule for understanding the history of all life. One molecule. And he had sequenced fragments of that, and then he compared them. The fragments would be like a word, and he would assemble all the fragments, and that would be a paragraph. So one paragraph of genomic sequence would represent one creature, then he'd have another paragraph for another creature, another paragraph, and he compared those, and in doing that, he discovered that these microbes that he'd been looking at, this particular group that were known as the methanogens, meaning that they generated methane, they lived in oxygen-poor environments, and they produced methane as a metabolic product, these critters were not bacteria, not even close to bacteria, and they were closer to us, the eukaryotes, based on that genomic sequencing. So I won't tell you that whole story, but that was the beginning of a radical change in our view of the history of life on Earth, even in our view of evolution. And that led to a series of other discoveries that I describe in the book, some of them made by Woese, some of them made by people who used his methods and worked on other creatures and other questions, some of them made by people who detested him but who were influenced by the revolution that he began anyway. And that led to a whole new understanding of not only of both the evolutionary history of this planet and the evolutionary process. Not overturning Charles Darwin, but adding significantly, surprisingly, to what Darwin and neo-Darwinism during the 20th century had proposed, held, what the orthodox view of Darwinian evolution was. One of those discoveries was something called horizontal gene transfer. Horizontal gene transfer, which means the passage of genes across species boundaries, even across boundaries between one kingdom to another, going sideways. Genes moving sideways instead of horizontally, instead of genes moving vertically from parent to offspring down through a lineage, which is the way it's supposed to happen. I first read about this only in 2013, and my reaction was, what? No, not possible. Genes don't pass across species boundaries, except in the very special cases of hybridizing by two very closely related species or subspecies. Yeah, we knew about that. We didn't know that genes from a bacteria could go into the genome of an insect. We didn't know that the genes from a kissing bug could go into the genome of an opossum. We didn't know that. Now we know that. That has happened. A simple phrase that was coined for understanding how that happened, coined in the 1950s by a great scientist named Joshua Lederberg. He discovered this among bacteria in the 1950s, but nobody imagined it happened in complex organisms. He called it infective heredity. How does it happen? Well, several different complicated mechanisms, but the simple answer is it happens by infection. A bacterium infects a human or a possum or something else, and if it infects not just in the belly of that creature or in the nasal passages of that creature, but if it infects the reproductive cells, if it gets inside the reproductive cells of a creature, egg cells, sperm cells, ovary cells, testes cells, then it's possible for the bacteria to drop some of its DNA in that cell and for that DNA to be incorporated into the DNA of that creature. That's horizontal gene transfer. And we now know that it happens, and it has caused these scientists that I write about to redraw the tree of life. The classic Darwinian tree of life that represents the history of evolution is appropriate because it has a single trunk and then it rises into limbs, and the limbs diverge into branches, and the branches diverge into smaller branches, and those diverge into twigs, and then finally have leaves across the canopy of the tree, and the living leaves on the canopy of the tree represent the living biological diversity on Earth right now, right? But it's all diverge, 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 diverge. There's a diagram in Darwin's The Origin of Species, and it's called the diagram of divergence, showing this. Horizontal gene transfer reveals to us that it's not just divergence. There also is convergence. Sometimes a branch grows sideways into another limb, and a branch from this limb grows sideways into that limb, and sap flows that way. Convergence as well as divergence. That's why this book is called The Tangled Tree. The real picture of the history of life on Earth is a tangle, not a classic tree. Parenthetically, this book wasn't called The Tangled Tree from the beginning, as Betsy well knows. I went 5 years with a different working title, which I loved. It seemed to me just right. And I would go to Germany or to, you know, New York or to Paris or whatever, and I'd talk to these scientists and interview them, and then finally they'd say, "What's the title of your book?" And I would tell them, and they'd say, "Yeah, okay, that's good." And I would then meet people in an elevator, and they would ask me, "What are you working on?" And I'd give them a 3-sentence answer, and they'd say, "What's the title?" And I'd tell them the title, and they would just look blank. So the original working title was The Tree of Life is Not a Tree. Okay, that was my original title. The Tree of Life is Not a Tree. I liked it. But finally, when I delivered the book after 5 years, my editor, the saintly Bob Bender at Simon & Schuster, and my agent, the saintly Binky Urban at ICM, said, "Please, for the love of God, you got to change the title. Give us a different title." That title is scary and confusing to readers. It's paradoxical. I said, "Of course it's paradoxical. It's supposed to be paradoxical. That's it. It's trying to express this paradox. No, please, something else." So I thought about it for a while, and then I came up with The Tangled Tree, and I'm very happy that they talked me into changing the title, because that allowed me to use the word life, not in the title, but in the subtitle. And it allowed me to come up with this wonderfully modest subtitle of this book, A Radical New History of Life. So it's okay. I'm happy. That was good advice. Maybe I'll read you a little bit. Just maybe 3 paragraphs. I've been talking about this guy, Carl Woese, at the center of this. And how many people here have seen the movie Citizen Kane? Everybody, right? Almost everybody. Okay, so Carl Woese is my Citizen Kane. Right? He's the guy who keels over dead in the first scene, and his last word is Rosebud. And then everybody goes through the movie trying to figure out, who was this guy? Was he great? Was he evil? Was he conniving? Was he inspirational? Was he all of those things? And what the hell did Rosebud mean, his final word? And so, if you remember, there's a faceless newsreel reporter who gets sent out by his editor, saying, "Get the story on this," I almost said Carl Woese, "this John Charles Foster Kane. Get the story on him." So this newsreel guy goes out, and his face literally doesn't appear, shadowed through all or most of his scenes. And he's the one who goes around to all these characters, you know, Cain's first wife and his second wife and his accountant, the wonderful Mr. Bernstein. And he asks them all, what was the deal? What was the meaning of the secret of this guy's life? Cain. Okay, so Carl Woese is my Citizen Kane, and I'm the faceless newsreel reporter who went around and talked to all those people. And here's just a little glimpse of him from right at the beginning, like the introduction of the book. Carl Woese was a complicated man, fiercely dedicated and very private, who seized upon deep questions, cobbled together ingenious techniques to pursue those questions, flouted some of the rules of scientific decorum, made enemies, ignored niceties, said what he thought, focused obsessively on his own research problem to the exclusion of most other concerns, and turned up at least one or two discoveries that shook the pillars of biological thought. I already mentioned one of them. To his close friends, he was an easy, funny guy. Caustic but wry, with a love for jazz, a taste for beer and scotch, and an amateurish facility on piano. To his grad students and postdoctoral fellows and laboratory assistants, most of them, he was a good boss and an inspirational mentor, sometimes, but not always, generous, wise, and caring. As a teacher, in the narrower sense, a professor of microbiology at the University of Illinois, he was almost non-existent as far as undergraduates were concerned. He didn't stand before large banks of eager, clueless students patiently explaining the ABCs of bacteria. Lecturing wasn't his strength or his interest, and he lacked eloquent forcefulness even when presenting his work at scientific meetings. He didn't like meetings. He didn't like travel. He didn't create a joyous collegial culture within his lab, hosting seminars and Christmas parties to be captured in group photos, as many senior scientists do. He had his chosen young friends, and some of them remember good times, laughter, beery barbecues at the Woese home just a short walk from the university campus. But those friends were the select few who somehow, by charm or by luck, had gotten through his shell. One more paragraph. In later years, as he grew more widely acclaimed, receiving honors of all kinds, short of the Nobel Prize, Woese seems to have grown bitter. He considered himself an outsider. He was elected to the National Academy of Sciences, an august body, but tardily, at age 60, and the delay annoyed him. He became, by some reports, distant from his family, a wife and two children, seldom mentioned in published accounts of his scientific labors. He was a brilliant crank, and his work triggered a drastic revision of one of the most basic concepts in biology, the idea of the tree of life, the great arboreal image of relatedness and diversification. For that reason, Woese's moment of triumph in Urbana on November 3rd, 1977, that was the New York Times thing, has its place near the core of this book. So that's just sort of setting the scene. So I'll say one other thing. There are, as I also explain in this little introductory chapter, which is titled Three Surprises, an Introduction, there are three large surprises that that Woese and his colleagues and his successors have brought to us about who we are, how we came to be, the history of life on Earth. One of those I already mentioned, the discovery of the archaea. The second was this discovery of this impossible or thought to be impossible phenomenon, horizontal gene transfer. And the third had to do also with the archaea, and that is, as thinking has developed just in the last 10 years, and people have been trying to figure out the origins of our complex cells, the eukaryotic cells, these cells with cell nuclei that compose all of our bodies, the bodies of all animals, plants, fungi, and other complex eukaryotic creatures. The work and the thinking has arrived at the conclusion that the host cell, the simple host cell from which our complex cells arose by several different, also amazing events that some of which I describe in the book, like the capture of bacteria, live bacteria, and turning those into internal organs in our bodies. That's the story that comes from Lynn Margulis. This process of the creation of the complex cell, the eukaryotic cell, began with a host cell. That was the receptacle for all this complexity that came in. It was our original ancestor. And the third surprise that comes from this work is that that host cell was almost certainly an archaean. It almost certainly belonged to this kingdom of life, the archaea, that we didn't even know existed before 1977. So the book talks about this tangled tree. It also talks about the mosaic character of complex creatures, including humans, about challenges to categorical ideas like the fact that a species is a discrete entity and genes don't cross in and out of it sideways. An individual is a discrete entity, and the history of life is shaped like a tree. And now we know that all three of those categorical ideas are wrong. That said, there are laughs in this book, I think, a few. There are people, there are interesting characters, there are wonderful men and women, and their stories are tangled together like the limbs of this tree. I'm going to stop there and see if anybody has questions.
Do you have to revise any of your previous writings from what you've discovered from writing this book because of evolution?
Okay, the answer to that question is no, because I've written a lot about Darwin and Darwinian theory and the development of that, and none of that is proven wrong by these discoveries. It's just proven incomplete. The analogy I use sometimes is kind of an obvious analogy, is that Carl Woese didn't falsify Darwin any more than Einstein falsified Isaac Newton. He just went beyond and explored the fact that things work differently when you get it at different scales of time or space. When I started, I published my first book in 1970, and a little bit of arithmetic will tell you that was 48 years ago. That was my first book. It wasn't nonfiction, it was fiction. So I started off as a fiction writer, and then I turned into a nonfiction writer in the late 70s because I couldn't stand to be a bartender in Missoula anymore. Why Carl Woese? The first answer, his training was in biophysics. He was not, one of his friends, another eminent biologist, told me, Carl wasn't even a biologist. He knew less biology than I know. An eminent biologist, and this guy was saying, you know, and I don't know anything because I study molecules. Woese was trained as an undergraduate at Amherst, if I recall correctly, and he did a PhD at Yale in biophysics. And then he went to work for the General Electric Company in Schenectady doing research on mice. And he had no idea what the General Electric research labs wanted from him. And he did that for a handful of years. And that's where this friend that I just quoted met him. This guy was a young 19-year-old employee, and Woese was 32, and they hit it off. And then he was offered a job at the University of Illinois. He wrote a book about the evolutionary origin of the genetic code, published in 1967. He was thinking about that. He was, in his mind, he was competing with people like Francis Crick, and others who were trying to solve the genetic code as a riddle. Genetic code means which letters composing the DNA or the RNA arranged in which ways create the amino acids that constitute parts of bodies, proteins. Woese didn't just want to solve the genetic code. He wanted to understand the origin of the genetic code. So what made Carl Woese different more than anything else is that he was this crotchety guy who had this deep, deep curiosity in pure science to understand what happened, to unravel the story of life going back 3 billion, 3.5 billion, maybe 3.8 billion years. He wanted to know that. And that's why he started doing what he was doing, sequencing this one particular molecule that's found in all forms of life, which has a fancy name, 16S ribosomal RNA. Now, nobody needs to remember that, but he'll run across it again in the book. 16S ribosomal RNA. And that, or a version of it, 18S, is found in every living creature on Earth because it's crucial to translating genetic information into body parts. It is a structural piece of this particular organ, the ribosome, that takes DNA, you would take instructions, and the DNA goes into this organ, and the organ functions like a 3D printer that's been given a program, and out comes a protein. Woese wanted to understand the origin of that. He had a deep, deep, deep curiosity, and that's how he made these discoveries. Oh, Ford Doolittle. Okay, so he's another important character for me. A fellow named Ford Doolittle, an American biologist who has spent his career in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and who knew Carl Woese when Doolittle was a postdoc briefly in Urbana, Illinois, and he used to drink beer with Carl Woese. And then he took a job in Halifax, and he did his own research, and he sort of went his own way. But then when people started getting full genome sequences, when sequencing of genetic material became much easier, cheaper, and quicker in the 1990s, people started being able to compare whole genomes with one another, and that's how they discovered horizontal gene transfer. Hey, here's a bacterial gene in an insect. What the hell is it doing there? How did it get there? It's not in any of the other relatives of that insect in the same family of insects. It doesn't seem to have come vertically. It seems to have come horizontally. Ford Doolittle was much involved, and he, besides being a brilliant molecular biologist and sort of a gadfly who liked unconventional ideas, he was an artist of some modest skill. He thought at one point about going into art. His father taught art history, he was thinking about making a career of art until his father told him that's a dumb idea. And then Sputnik went up, and he decided, oh, okay, I better be a scientist because we need scientists now that the Russians have a satellite. So he became a scientist. And then when he finally started studying horizontal gene transfer, he was asked to write an article for the journal Science about what was new in microbiology. And he said, I'm going to write it about horizontal gene transfer because it's the most important thing that's happening. And he wrote this very very learned technical review article in the journal Science, and he drew a tree of life with a magic marker or a ballpoint, a tangled tree of life. And if I had been doing PowerPoint tonight, which I didn't want to do because I thought it would be too formal, and I would show you that. But it is in the book, his image, Ford Doolittle's Tree of Life on, I don't know what page it's on, but it's in here. And the fact that he was a cartoonist of talent was also a very important factor in putting across the idea of horizontal gene transfer, because it sounds abstract. What's the tangled tree of life, this paradox? Well, look in the book and find the Ford Doolittle illustration. That's the tangled tree of life. I did a book called Spillover about zoonotic diseases, zoonoses, mostly viruses that lurk in non-human animals and spill over occasionally into humans and cause, in some cases, very nasty diseases like Ebola and Hendra and HIV and a whole list of other scary things. I researched that whole book and wrote it. It took another 5 or 6 years, and I didn't even come across the phrase horizontal gene transfer. So these things, they seem adjacent, and they are adjacent, but they both involve infection. They both involve viruses, at least some of the time. And yet, this subject has been so hermetically sealed within the community of scientists who work on it, until now, I hope, that I didn't even hear about it myself until I finished that book, did a book tour, went back to my life, and started thinking about what the next book would be, and then came across this phrase, horizontal gene transfer, and started reading Ford Doolittle about it, and saw his drawing, and then came across this other name, Carl Woese, and was off on a tangent again. Yes. In some cases, it's viruses. I mentioned several mechanisms for this, and those are conjugation, transduction, and transformation. Conjugation, right. And that was the one that was known early. Josh Lederberg in the 1950s saw that, and Esther Lederberg working together. And then these other two, transformation. Transformation was discovered in the 1920s by Fred Griffith in England, when he was looking at different strains of pneumococcal pneumonia and trying to figure out why some forms of harmless pneumococcus could suddenly be turned into virulent pneumococcus. All right? And he discovered that what was happening, he discovered that that was happening, and then a great scientist named Oswald Avery in the 1940s, famously with two colleagues, McCarty and McLeod. Avery, McCarty, and McLeod is a famous paper in scientific history, 1944. They figured out that what was happening in this transformation of bacterial strains from non-virulent to virulent was that something, they called it a pablum, a mysterious pablum, was being passed from bacteria that had been split open, exploded, into bacteria that were still living. And there was, when the bacteria exploded, there was something that was still in the environment that got into the living bacterium and changed it. That was transformation, the transforming principle. What was it? Well, it was a thing called DNA. It was the first discovery that DNA was genetic material, 1944, Oswald Avery. That was transformation. So you got conjugation, bacteria to bacteria, transformation. Loose DNA in an environment is taken up by an organism, usually a bacterium or an archaean. And then transduction, which means essentially drag and drop by viruses. A virus infects one organism, picks up some of its DNA from its nucleus, and then descendants, replicants of that viral particle, infect another organism, carry it in, and if they infect the reproductive cells, eggs, sperm, ovaries, testes, and they drop that DNA, it's possible for it to become heritable and part of the genome. And the most dramatic instance or formulation of this that I came across doing research on this was the fact that 8% of the human genome we now know is viral DNA that has gotten into our permanent heritable lineage from retroviruses, viruses that go backwards, like HIV. But HIV goes backwards in immune cells and patches its DNA into an immune cell. And then when the immune cell replicates, it replicates the viral DNA, and eventually it explodes, and there's a lot of more virus particles. Eventually gives a person AIDS. If the retrovirus infects not the immune cells, but the reproductive cells, eggs, sperm, ovary, testes, and inserts itself into that DNA, it becomes heritable. 8% of our genomes, including a viral gene called sensitin 2, discovered by a man named Thierry Heidemann in Paris and his group, a viral gene that the original retrovirus, it made an envelope protein, sort of a membrane that wrapped the viral particle. Now it's in humans, and in female humans, it makes another kind of membrane, the membrane that goes between the placenta and the fetus. And without that membrane, created by a viral gene, pregnancy is impossible. Successful pregnancy is impossible. The challenge to the idea of individual, I'll try and do this very concisely. First of all, I've already said 8% of our genome is DNA that comes to us not through the continuous lineage of animal evolution, but sideways over the last 100 million years, but still sideways from viruses. So we're 8% viral. We're also partly bacterial because one of the most important organs within all of our cells is something called the mitochondrion. We have a lot of mitochondria in every cell, and those are the organs that package energy for us to allow a complex cell to do all of the amazing things that it does. Those mitochondria, we now know, because of Lynn Margulis and Carl Woese and Ford Doolittle, we now know that those are captured bacteria. That somewhere in the deep history, the part that Woese was interested in, when complex cells were being formed, the original host cell, maybe it was an archaea cell, swallowed or was infected by a single bacterial particle. And that bacterial particle, just one time in history, that bacterial particle was not digested and was not expelled, but lingered in that cell and replicated itself and stayed in the descendants of that cell when the cell replicated and eventually turned into mitochondria. So that's why you hear about mitochondrial DNA and mitochondrial Eve. It's different, and you can answer different questions using mitochondrial DNA, which is inherited only through the female side because the mitochondria are in egg cells but not in sperm cells. So, you know, we all have the mitochondrial DNA that we got from our mothers, all of us, and we don't have any mitochondrial DNA from our fathers. There are questions that you can answer with it. And where was I going with that? So we are part bacterial. That is bacterial DNA. That's why it's different from our own genome. That's why mitochondrial DNA is different from our genome, because it came from a bacterium. It's bacterial DNA. Goals. Understand the history of life on Earth better. Only that. Pure science. Aims. Possibilities. Well, it has medical implications. I've just described how important it is to understanding the phenomenon of antibiotic resistance and the spread of antibiotic resistance. So it has very important medical implications in that sense. But Carl Woese, at the end of his life, wrote a number of manifestos, and he said he was disgusted with the degree to which he was such a wonderful crank, the degree to which molecular biology had turned into an engineering discipline. And what he meant was science should be about more than figuring out what's the next big breakthrough to allow humans to live to the age of 100 instead of 95. In his view, that was an understandable concern, but a trivial question in the long view of science. And he was more interested in figuring out, where did we begin? And where does our human identity and the identity of every blue whale and malarial protozoan and bacteria on Earth, where does that begin? And what did it look like when we were all part of the same trunk of a single tree?